ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm speaking with David Bishop, president of David Bishop Media, an advisory firm serving the media industry and providing executive leadership development. Previously, David served as the successful and visionary president for not one, but two multi-billion dollar leading global media companies, Sony Pictures Home Entertainment and MGM Worldwide Home Entertainment. Working in the arena of executive development, David has an amazing track record developing leaders in the entertainment space at companies like Netflix, Sony, Google, IMAX, and Amazon. He also helped create and serves on the advisory board for the University of Southern California's Third Space Thinking Center, which focuses on leadership development. He's also served as a board chair and board director of several high-potential startups and media industry groups, where his strategic insight, analytical mindset, and knowledge of how to use technology as a game changer have added tremendous value. He's currently a director at Parrot Analytics and an advisor to 3PM Shield, and has been inducted into Variety's Home Entertainment Hall of Fame. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here.
The entertainment industry is undergoing a real sea change and disruption to business models and changes in consumer behavior, new entrants, and all of this means that successful leaders need to be able to move their organizations forward quickly and need to be able to pivot to meet change. And you consult in the fields of leadership, organizational change, and culture. And whereas change used to be something that happened sort of periodically, it's not only constant, but accelerating. And I'm curious if you believe there are structural designs that help position organizations to be nimble, or if it's really the right people at the helm, regardless of the overall structure, that helps to create a sufficiently flexible, nimble organization?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, you know, we are in times, as you mentioned, that there's more change than ever before. And actually there, it's even so much so that there's an acronym for it. I don't know if you've heard the term VUCA.
Oh, say that again. It's
VUCA. Okay. It's V-U-C-A. And it actually came out of the military when they found themselves where all their past strategies and tactics didn't work anymore. You know, they no longer, when you went to war, was it, you know, you line up your troops or you fly over a battlefield and drop the military in. It was really more chaotic. And so they had to adapt. And then through this change, actually, the business community has adapted this paradigm, if you will. And VUCA stands for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous.
Huh. You know, it's funny. We spoke with Colonel Carlos Vega, who heads up the Army cybersecurity about leadership, and he did not use the acronym. So I'm feeling flat-footed. I'm going to have to speak to Carlos about that.
Go back to him.
That's right. I'll slap him around.
So he needs some leadership counseling, and then.
So given that that's the state of play, so are we looking at sort of the, give the sexism of the term, the great man theory, or is it a structural thing, or is it a combination of both?
Yeah, I don't think it's really about structure. I think it's more about attitude. It's more about the core values of an organization, which enables them to be on the balls of their feet and not really flat-footed in this ever-changing world. So it's really a adapting an attitude of embracing change, embracing people in the organization, experimenting and failing, and you know, celebrating those mistakes even, so that you create this learning organization.
Right. So we're talking about a sincere cultural shift, because I think that a lot of organizations will say, oh, yes, embrace change. And yet people get punished for failure. And it's very hard to embrace change and be experimental if there is a job risk, you know, a political cost to doing that.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. And that's hard, you know, and you referenced the traditional media business, which is, you know, really under siege with disruptors all around. And it's hard to look at your cash cow, your existing revenue stream and admit that is all subject to change and not get in a protective mode.
Right.
And that's what you've seen happen, you know, in the industries that I came from TV and film. We saw that there was this clinging to the traditional model, and now all of them are trying to catch up.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Right? I had a lunch thing at the Paley Center, and Ken Lowe from Scripps was talking about where change has happened and how, you know, the cable industry didn't grow out of broadcast and the digital industry hasn't grown out of cable, you know, and sort of, it's interesting sort of how disruption happens. And in some ways, disruption happens to companies who are doing well enough to have risk of losing the good enough, you know? And so it's oblique angles that comes at these new players coming in. But I wanted to back up a little bit, because you've sat at the top of some really large organizations, which, you know, I think in some ways the change, like home entertainment, really took a hit sooner than some of the linear television did, certainly. And yet you were able to sustain success. So what do you, given all that you've seen, what does sustained organizational success require? Is it truly just the culture? I mean, what else is at play?
Yeah, I think it certainly starts and is rooted in culture. You know, otherwise you're not going to be able to maximize the revenue that's in the market.
Right.
Right. So you need to adapt this attitude of looking to the future, looking at trends, looking at where your organization fits within the trends that are in this marketplace. So it's adapting a mindset that realizes that things are going to change. Things are going to change rapidly, and we can't just, you know, hunker down and protect what we have. We have to evolve.
Right.
So in my case, it meant doing things like taking 30 of the key executives in the organization, doing an offsite, preparing them with information about trends in the marketplace that they can read beforehand,
mm-hmm.
and then start to brainstorm together to paint possible scenarios that mm-hmm. could happen in the near and long term, and start to think about how we reposition ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So not only, I guess I'm curious, not only, so this is sort of how we can be successful, but are there also drag factors, if you will, that hold companies or individuals back? And so that if you are an individual and you are sitting currently in a network and you're looking at your team or your players, what are some things that are, you should say, you know, would be flags for you that you need to intervene and change things up?
Yeah, I think actually going back to the military in a way, there was this whole command and control style of leadership where people looked to the leader for thoughts, for innovation, for direction. And really you need to flip that model to almost to the point where the leader is following and looking to the individuals in the organization to help them understand where the next step should be. So
right.
I think that's that's critical. And, you know, certainly there are examples of leaders who have a really good product and the leadership mindset, if you will, doesn't matter. You know, so we can look at recent examples, you know, like you wouldn't define Steve Jobs as, you know, a virtuous leader.
No, you know, yes, a challenging individual. His culture wasn't necessarily as warm and fuzzy, for sure. That's funny.
And now that culture has changed. But at the time, they had a really, you know, great product and everybody wanted it. And, you know, the same is true for companies like Uber. Right.
Well, you know, it's interesting though. You make an interesting point, because I would say that Apple's in trouble right now as far as its core user group. I mean, its products are sort of meh. And so you have, you know, the culture, the innovator, the singular visionary leader versus a different. I mean, it's an interesting conundrum. To the military example, have you ever read Stanley McChrystal's Team of Teams book?
No, I haven't.
That is exactly the approach he discusses in that book. I think you'd enjoy it. Anyway, the side note there. Yeah, he's fascinating on the sort of how you know, changing it up when they got to Iraq. But I want to make sure we talk about the Third Space Thinking Center at USC. Now, is that a leadership development center? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So this started at the Annenberg Center of USC, which is actually the communication school. So when people learn about a leadership development program, obviously they would think about the Marshall School at USC, which is the business school.
Right.
But there was a path that the dean of that school led, where initially he was looking to instill in the students at the Annenberg School what qualities or what agilities do they need to have to be successful in the workforce. So because they're research driven, they did 3 or 4 years to try to uncover what ended up being these 5 skills that are important to CEOs around the world in this ever-changing world that we described.
Mm-hmm.
So where it's evolved is that now we're building workshops and programs to take into the private sector to also teach this skill set, which is, you know, proven to be effective from a leadership perspective. You know, in fact, the research shows that leaders who adopt these kind of softer skills actually produce higher return on investment than those who do not. To the tune of like 5 times the return on investment.
How, I mean, do you, just as a sort of philosophical question, do you believe that, I mean, obviously you can learn skills and you can improve where you are, but the transformative leader that we all sort of hope to become or seek, is some of that just the personality of the person, or do you really believe that if you apply yourself, anybody can become that leader?
Yes. I mean, there are obviously certain things within us that are hardwired.
Right.
And even some thinking preferences, you know, there's an assessment tool that I'm certified in that can measure thinking preferences. And what the studies show is those, you know, people who are more inclined to focus on strategy and long-term results and things like that, over time, those tendencies don't change, but you're able to kind of work within those tendencies so that you can be effective in any of the areas, you know, whether it's analytic or more social. Those types of things can be learned, understood, and you can work with as an individual. Now, the neuroscience is starting to become part of the fabric of human and organizational performance. So what's happening there is there's, you know, the science of human performance, sports psychology, counseling and clinical psychology are all starting to come together. And what the result is, we're learning that many of these softer skills, if you will, are absolutely learnable. And much like if you're working out or you're running, that muscle memory starts to kick in. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't start out as an empathetic person or a person who is self-aware, you can absolutely learn that skill with practice.
Right. Okay. So, you know, one of the things I guess that I'm curious about is many organizations with sort of middling success would say the same things that those organizations that are very successful, they say, you know, we want to put the customer first. We want clarity in the management structure. We want to innovate. They say all the right things, but for whatever reason, the execution just isn't happening. When you go into an organization and you're counseling them and you're working with the leadership and all of the official language is right, but obviously it's not paying off. How do you, I mean, there's some pretty difficult messages, I imagine, because, you know, senior level people don't necessarily want to hear that they're not doing it right. So how do you go about, and is that often the problem? What is the, how do you assess the problem? And then how do you have some of those difficult conversations?
Yeah. So, you know, the employees are the best mirror for any organization, right? So you can say all the right things, but if you're not consistent with your actions or your words or this, you know, this vision of being a, you know, being a customer oriented organization, is not in the fabric of the organization, the best place to start is with the employees. And I've found through my experience that employee engagement studies tell you a lot. If your message is getting through, there's also a growing pool of research that shows that if your employee engagement is at a high level, and that's, you know, anywhere from say 80% on up, your financial results will be better. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a growing number of examples in this world, in this new world, right? So you take, for instance, Facebook, where, you know, I actually went up there with the USC people to talk about third space thinking. And you can tell that everywhere they understand that they have these, you know, these five values that everyone can speak to, that is reinforced constantly in their messaging. You know, it enables them to be bold, to focus on impact, to, you know, they actually have an expression that I think they've since tempered a bit, where they said, move fast and break things.
Ah, okay.
So it kind of goes back to this.
Fail quickly, kind of.
Yeah, fail quickly, celebrate your failures, learn from them, and move on. And, you know, rather than accept the status quo, it starts to foster an environment of innovation. And when you walk on that campus, you can feel that. You can feel the energy and the independence that people have within that company.
Right, right. So that's a company that's working well. And I agree with the employees often do know what's what. I've often, the joke with consultants is that they borrow your watch to tell you the time. So, you know, I've seen some leadership situations where, you know, because I'm a vendor who works with different clients, I'll see leadership situations where really senior level people are involving themselves in discussions that perhaps they should delegate and trust their team, and that it undermines their team. And that what they then do is they review and rework processes over and over and over again. But cult, you know, we have a great product, but we need to be speedier. But if they're inserting themselves into the approvals of everything, which they might want to allow, you know, the question is, if they don't trust their subordinates, should they, is there a staffing issue maybe? If an employee sees this situation and, you know, they're process reengineering and process reengineering, is there a politically safe way for them to help improve the situation up? Or is it really a non-starter? What advice would you give to that person?
Yeah, I mean, I play with this concept I call lead from any chair.
Yeah, okay.
Right, so if you're going to have a leader that has that mindset, and that, you know, you, as you mentioned, sometimes it shows up as, oh, we have a new process, or, you know, it's Six Sigma this month, and in next quarter it's going to be something else.
Right.
Sometimes they tinker with the design of the organization. They say, okay, well, we're not getting the results, so we need to restructure, and this department needs to report to that department. And those are all kind of signs that the organization or the leader needs help. But, you know, I don't like this concept where the people within the organization feel that they have to constantly look up to the leader like they were a parent.
Mm.
Prefer them to sort of start where they are and start to exhibit the behaviors that, you know, will start to spread around the organization, right? So even someone who has a 5-person department, if they start to delegate more, if they start to create alignment around strategic goals and what the mission is,
mm-hmm.
people really need to understand why they're getting up in the morning to come to work.
Right.
Then that attitude can start to spread throughout an organization, and people recognize it as something that's healthy and producing good results.
So you're saying, just to rephrase to make sure I'm understanding you properly, in this kind of scenario that I've painted, even if the boss is just constantly rejiggering things, you, in your own bailiwick, you start leading the way you believe will be efficient. You do those things within those things that are within your purview, and that this will percolate up? Is that, or it will?
That's certainly a way, and a way to take some control and some responsibility within uh-huh. your organization. Obviously, if it's a top-down initiative, it will move faster and create better results.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean, if it's not happening at the top, it doesn't mean you can't start the revolution from wherever you're sitting in a team.
Right, right. I also had a question. One of your blog posts, you talked about being humble, which I really liked. I thought that was excellent. And you made an interesting point, and I'm going to read to you, read to the audience. It says, think about what you say and why you're saying it. Do not say things just for the greater glory of yourself. If you're speaking about something that feels really good to share, but there is no room for the other person to add value, then you're likely just saying it to pat yourself on the back. Now, I guess, does that mean that there are no complete ideas that one can share? Or is it that you have to be willing to cede control of an idea? Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think it goes back to, you know, this sort of leadership style that is important to create in any culture. And you know, you really need an attitude where people feel, okay, we did this, we accomplished this.
Ah.
So if you start to add too much ego into it, mm-hmm. then you're destroying that concept in the process.
Right. So the shared ownership of the outcome.
Yes, exactly right.
So if we can just go back, I don't know if it's secret and you can't share, or if you can a little bit, but you had mentioned 5 skills
yeah.
that had come out of the Third Space Thinking Center. Can you tell us what the 5 skills are?
I'd be happy to.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so they are adaptability.
Okay.
Cultural competency. And when we talk about cultural competency, it's really 2 areas, right? We're living in a more global environment. We're in there's more diversity within companies. So it's having that ability and understanding to be able to work within those differences in culture, mm-hmm. right? Around, or cultures. It also means having a better understanding of the departments, right? And in an effort to break down silos. So it's understanding what finance does and what operations does and business affairs does. So that there's this, you know, seamless flow of communication and understanding what each department's function is within an organization.
Uh-huh.
Then, you know, we've kind of touched on empathy, which is the third skill set in third space thinking. And, you know, I think the advantages there or the inherent advantages are apparent in empathy. The fourth is intellectual curiosity. And then the last is 360 degree thinking.
And is that within the organization? Is that around the market? Is it just what is covered in the 360 degrees?
Yes. You know, my quick answer is yes.
I knew as I was speaking it that that's where it was going. It was a stupid question, but okay.
It's important to note that it's different from 360 degree feedback,
yes.
Right?
Which is, yes.
You know, a common buzzword these days, and feedback is important and it helps you grow, but that's from the outside.
Right.
So in this case, 360 degree is more, a bit more internal. And, you know, it's a way for you to use the past, the present, and the future to be able to solve problems and course correct if you need to.
Right. I have a question. I want to drill down a little bit into intellectual curiosity because I couldn't agree more. But one of the things, and it's sort of one of the reasons behind the podcast, actually, was to create a place to house interesting things. But one of the challenges that I'm seeing among my clients is time. They are spending an excessive amount of time in meetings about things, but they aren't necessarily able to have quiet, reflective time where they can read and explore things, you know, that may not immediately result in something, but you sort of file that away. And then in the back of your mind, some web thinking happens and you connect A and B and you have an aha moment. But if you don't have the quiet time for reflection, if you don't have the time to read, that isn't going to happen. So what do we do about our over meeting, over schedulized? What's going on there? And if you go into an organization and all of your EVPs are running around like meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting, what do you say? What do you do?
Yeah, it's a hard discipline to instill within an organization. And, you know, I'm sure you have been in situations as I have where you sit in a meeting and the outcome of the meeting is let's have another meeting. and that's a, you know, that's a treadmill that people need to get off of. You know, we tried and to some degree of success, tried to at least instill that mindset by disallowing meetings on certain days of the week. We would have Fridays where we weren't actually allowed to have a meeting.
That's interesting.
So it encouraged people to either pick up the phone or walk over to the office or email, but it was, you know, a way to just get people to realize that you don't need 10 people in a meeting to get things done.
I had a boss who also used to have meetings where everybody had to stand. That worked. You quickly decided that you actually didn't have to be at that meeting or you could resolve it in a different way. It was an interesting technique for sure. But I think time pressure is still, and also the other thing that feeds in, it's not only meetings, but we are entering, in fact, I just got a report from McKinsey, the data, we're fire hosing data ourselves, you know. And at what point, I mean, do you just keep churning through data? I mean, when, you know, I'm going to read the headline of the report. It's the age of analytics. This is what we're in, according to McKinsey. So big data, small data, data sets, reports, and sort of over optionalizing, you know, we're going to look at all of the things. At what point would you, in your experience, would you just decide to say, well, I've had enough inputs and now I just really have to move forward? How did you make that decision?
Yeah, you know, you can definitely get stuck in analysis paralysis. And, you know, I think if you utilize data in the proper way, it's a really powerful tool. But I try to use data as a way to reinforce my gut so that when you build up enough experience, you sort of know what the right decision is. But mm-hmm. sometimes you actually need the data as a point of reflection, right?
Right.
And you know, it's a point you discussed earlier. So it is a very, very useful tool, especially in understanding the patterns that are happening in the marketplace. But to your point, everything can be overutilized. You know, there's a downside to everything that we're talking about, including, you know, these third space attributes. You can be too empathetic.
Right.
And that has a negative impact. So in all of this, whether you're an individual or an organization, you're looking to strike the right balance.
Sort of a moderation of yeah. things. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I've actually chewed up my half hour of your time. But before we go, there's one thing that I like to do. It's just sort of a game to wrap up the conversation. And I say a series of words and you just top of mind respond. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Facebook.
Innovation.
Google.
Culturally competent.
Snapchat.
I'm on the fence.
Twitter.
We'll see.
you shouldn't laugh. YouTube.
Rapidly expanding.
Ad blockers.
We need them.
Art.
Essential.
VR.
Finding its place.
AR.
The next big thing.
AI.
A useful tool in the short and long term.
And what excites you most about what you see on the horizon and the changes?
Well, if we're talking about the leadership development changes, I get excited about this intersection between science and performance.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I love knowing that there's this science behind it. I think that that's and how we as people, how we tend to behave and why it's effective. I think that's so compelling when you're talking to people. It's very interesting. Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thank you. Our production team over at Microfame Media, a big thank you. And thank you to our guest and new friend, David Bishop. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.